Good morning. Today is Friday. It's a 14, not a 13 of April. Joining us this morning is Humble Bay Fire Assistant Chief, or Assistant Humble Bay Fire Chief. Which way is it?
Actually, it's Deputy Fire Chief.
Oh.
You were close, though.
Deputy Assistant.
Same,
Billy
same,
Reynolds.
Same animal.
All right. Deputy. Oh, boy. Are you ready for some clever insight?
I am always ready for that.
All right. Self-starter. Why do we say that someone is a self-starter?
Oh, man. If I had to grasp at a straw, I would say it has something to do with the auto industry. Back when, you know, the horseless carriage became the new thing, people use that as a euphemism for being a motivator. I don't know.
You're close, dude. Byron Carter of Carter fame stopped one day in 1910 to help a lady in distress. Trying to crank her car, he broke his jaw and eventually died from the injury. Largely because of that incident, Cadillac builder Henry Leland gave Charles Kettering an order for 4,000 electric starters. Most engineers said that an electric self-starter for autos couldn't be made. They calculated that a 5-horsepower motor would be needed for it. With batteries, a car would be too heavy to move under its own weight. Kettering adopted an electric motor used on cash registers. With generator, clutch, and storage battery added, his self-starter was used in the 1912 Cadillac. Now anyone could crank the car by pushing a button with the toe of her shoe. So much wonder was evoked by the self-starter that it came to indicate any person capable of getting things rolling at the push of a metal button.
Well, there you go.
So you were right there.
Even a broken clock's right twice a day, so... So I got my one.
So are you saying you're broke or your timepiece?
Yes.
Fair enough. Budget time. Do you get a play in that, or is that all Sean's responsibility?
It's mostly Sean's responsibility, but I have some input there, and basically, obviously, looking forward to the year and the things we want to accomplish, and does it
change year to year?
It does. Obviously, there's different focuses with different new programs that come up. One of the best examples I can use is obviously training. Training needs to change from year to year with new personnel versus people that go to the paramedic program for training and whatnot. And so it is variable. So we need to basically look at the needs of the department and kind of have a SWOT analysis to see, you know, what we need.
When training is there, obviously there are new chemical compounds. Okay, so you got to figure out, can you touch it or sniff it or get close to it, or does it blow up, that kind of stuff.
Right.
But the basics, is there remedial training or the equivalent of remedial training or basic training? Is that as stressed as some of the new, more avant-garde or trendy things that come along?
Absolutely. That's actually the core of our training program is basically, you know, practice so you can't get it wrong. And obviously the time to do that is not on the fire ground when things are happening for real. So our crew spend a lot of time down at the training grounds going over the basics of fire attack, ventilation, search and rescue, and whatnot. And that's really, and especially now that our department's gotten so young, we have so many new people that reinforcing those basics is paramount.
They don't have the 10-year memory right now.
Right, exactly. And it's that muscle memory is not there yet, but they're getting there, obviously, with more experience. But we also have our specialty programs, like you mentioned, hazmat and things like that. They have continuing education that's not only mandated, but is necessary to keep their skills up and make sure that they're, you know, have the latest techniques and hazards and whatnot in mind when they're doing their jobs. So,
does the department have to work on dealing with mental cases? I don't know how to say it. People under the influence of drugs or substance. Is that becoming more and more of this training regimen that your folks have to go and deal with? Or do you just kind of stand back and let the cops show up and their folks from DHHS to kind of take care of that?
It's actually a huge part of our emergency medical services training. I've been an EMT going on 30 years now. Even back when I first got my certification, that was a big part of it because you know, if we're going into a scene and it's known to be violent or there's something like that going on, our dispatcher will tell us to stage and hold until law enforcement can get there. However, sometimes we get sent to a scene for run-of-the-mill difficulty breathing or chest pains. We get there and the person's having some sort of an episode that's precipitating the chest pain or difficulty breathing. And we need to have that training to be able to deal with that even without law enforcement. Now, they obviously have tools to deal with that in law enforcement, but we obviously have a little bit different focus as far as patient care and whatnot. So it's a huge part of our training to be able to help de-escalate things and to be able to deal with stuff like that.
Does that include family members, household members, people who might be kind of around who either want to get in the way, either to help or to hinder?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of times, you know, when we go to a call, our firefighters go to a call on the engine company, they have three firefighters, the captain, firefighter, and engineer. And usually the firefighter or the firefighter paramedic is doing the lead patient care, but the captain's kind of sitting back from the scene, not only, you know, helping as needed, but also kind of keeping an overview of what's going on. And if they start seeing something, or if anybody on the scene starts seeing something that's kind of going sideways with a family member, it's their job to help try to deal with that. So we can still focus on that patient and give good patient care, but also not have something that's becoming a potential hazard to us.
How do you tell if somebody's having an epileptic seizure versus a reaction to something else that might manifest similarly?
Well, the biggest thing would be medical history. When we do patient care on somebody, we'd be saying, is there any history of, you know, diabetes, seizures, heart history, whatever you're asking? If they say, oh yeah, Bob's an epileptic. As an EMT, I don't diagnose somebody, but when the paramedic gets there, or if you have a firefighter paramedic on scene, they can look at somebody and go, okay, this is maybe what probably is causing that, and go from there, and we report that to the hospital. The other thing, if they have no history of seizures, yet they say, well, they were taking something, they're taking a new medication, or they took drug X, Y, or Z, that we can basically say, okay, I don't know for sure that that's causing that. That's for a doctor to determine, but this could be a factor that's involved in that.
So you would see a possible drug-related response?
Potentially.
I guess would be the
simplest
way. Yeah,
potentially, but there's a lot of things that could be causing a seizure. So again, epilepsy, if they have the history of it, definitely. But again, just gathering that history is paramount to make sure we do the right things.
How do you find that out? Just by anybody who might be around?
If there's family members there, or if there's if the person's conscious and coming out of it, we can ask them questions. Or medical alert bracelets, like that show that basically, you know, they have a condition.
Duh, the medical bracelet. I forgot. Yeah. KINS. Maybe you have one for memory also?
Oh, man.
Hanging around my neck?
I'm with you.
Yeah, all right. It's 8:19.
Murphy's Markets has everything you need to get through your day the healthy way. From drinks to snacks and everything in between, right now, Amy and Brian coconut water is only $1.99. Brew Dr. Kombucha drinks are also just $1.99. And Annie's homegrown products are $2.49. A 6-ounce Yoplait yogurt is only 79 cents. And don't forget about Chicken of the Sea tuna, 4 for $5. Get a boost for your day by stopping by Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Billy Reynolds, the deputy fire chief for Humble Bay Fire. See, I got it this time. Huh?
Oh, you're all good.
Yeah. I just have to look at you and think, Barney Fife.
Wow. I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Yeah. Well, you know. Change the title, but change the image.
But I'm one of the people out there sort of who Barney Fife is. So
are you saying that's age related?
I think so.
Thanks. Thanks a lot. If we start whistling, watch out.
Oh, man.
Oh, too much fun. With the training that is now mandated versus the training that you would like to have, is there a big difference?
I think so. I mean, there's always, when you get into the fire service, there's different specialties that people gravitate towards, whether it's hazardous materials specialist or becoming a water rescue person. And but then, you know, the mandated training may not be as exciting, may not be as what you're, you know, obviously with the mandates that we have in EMS as far as being a mandated reporter for abuse situations, things like that. may not be as interesting, but they're such a necessary part of what we do, because we see, again, being the first people there on most medical aid calls and stuff like that, we're the first people that get that impression and actually see what's going on. So while it may not be as exciting to a younger firefighter, it's some of the most important stuff that we do.
You mentioned the that documentation. I'm a lot more aware of these mandated reporting elements that all levels of government, all areas have to do, have right. to deal with. Does everybody get that? I mean, you get your newbie shows up, he wants to throw water down or get somebody up. Are they really looking for that kind of stuff? Or is it more of a memory afterwards as the reports are being written? What has to happen? I would hate to think that they were worried about government forms rather than taking care of job one.
Right. So every call that we go on does get documented by the company officer or the captain of on the engine for basically an incident report, basically saying what we did, what we saw, what the conditions were, whether it's a fire, whether it's a medical aid. So that's documented on every call. But and we have the luxury, too, that when we go to a call, there's three of us there. The firefighters are, the engine company. So there's always somebody looking for that stuff. And after, if we go to a call that looks a little odd, or we see something, or one of the people on the call, the captain, engineer, or firefighter says, did you guys notice that, you know, that there was a lot of rotten food on the counters and stuff like that? Maybe the others didn't see it, but they are like, well, I didn't see it, but I did notice that the patient was really dirty, that like they were taking care of themselves. So what we'll ask people to do when we get back, it's not a standard thing, but if it's a call where there was a special circumstance, the captain will ask the engineer and the firefighter to say, you know, can you guys write basically a little supplement of what you saw, and I'll include that with my incident report. And that way, if we take it to Adult Protective Services or Child Protective Services, there's that much more documentation to say, this is what we saw, and it didn't quite sit well with us.
So general impressions, you don't have to worry about things like, I know in the law enforcement, the race, the ethnicity of,
right,
things of that nature. You don't have to get to that level, or do you?
We don't, basically. It's basically based on the conditions that we see there. It has nothing really to do with...
So situational.
Situational, correct. Yeah.
Huh. Do you get a lot of those requests for public information or requests for information?
Every so often they come across.
Novel rather than routine.
Absolutely. But the other thing that we have to be concerned about, too, is with HIPAA, the privacy laws. Obviously, if there's an EMS report written, we record patient information, but we have to be careful what's released, because, again, there's confidentiality, then we want to make sure that we're honoring that. Now, obviously, we do see subpoenas from time to time for criminal cases, whether it's an arson fire or whether it's an assault or a homicide or something that we responded to. We do basically get subpoenaed and have to send our incident reports to basically be reviewed by the courts and the attorneys and whatnot for further legal action.
Do you guys ever have to go to court and testify?
Absolutely. Our fire investigators do on a regular basis.
Okay, the investigators, that would be logical.
That makes sense. But also, if we have a case that would involve basically a crime against another person, again, an assault, assault with a deadly weapon.
Sure.
We'll send people for that, and they'll ask basically what we saw, what we did when we got there. And if there was any other, obviously, based on the incident report that they've already reviewed and everything, so they do get subpoenaed on a regular basis for things like that, cases.
I've seen the fire truck out in front of the courthouse, and I always thought it was a response rather than something like that.
Right.
Do the guys have to come in on their time off, or is that part of their shift, or you adjust the schedule for them?
Both. If they basically are on shift, we'll try to find coverage for them so they can be basically free and clear to go do that. But they do have to come in on their off-duty time. It just depends on the date that the court pushes forward. So we try to give them ample notification and fill their shift if we need to, but everything. But we do send them in off-duty.
I can't imagine if you had, I'm thinking of the grocery store parallel, right?
Right.
You got three guys two guys in the store, one in the truck. Here comes an incident. Gotta go, Judge. Out the door they go, and down the steps and off to the races.
Yeah, and that's why we try to send basically just one person, because if we can get coverage for them and keep the engine in service, then that we avoid basically having to say, the engine's delayed response or out of service until they come back and run a unit short. So
yeah, hold that thought, guys. Yeah, we'll be out of court sometime in the next little bit. Yeah. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
Now, here's your host, Lars Larson.
Hey there, it's Lars Larson. Join me for the Lars Larson Show, weeknights 10 to midnight. Honestly provocative talk radio on KINS.
KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We're back talking shop this morning with Billy Reynolds from Hubble Bay Fire. The training that we're kind of talking about that you'd like to have a little bit more box or maybe freed dollars with the existing budget to go into. The cops now are riding with somebody who is a mental health clinician. Maybe not clinician, but somebody from mental health because they have a certain number or certain percentage of their calls, and that's what they're dealing with. As a de-escalator, are there fire departments in the country that have, I guess it'd be a counselor? I mean, I don't know what the real professional term is, but we'll use our educational background and say school counselor.
Right.
To ride along with the school nurse to take care of whatever might be the issue.
Yeah, we don't see it a whole lot in California, but other states have what is called community paramedicine. And it's basically what they'll do is they'll team a fire department paramedic, usually a captain paramedic who can make command decisions, with either a healthcare provider such as a PA or a nurse, or they'll have them teamed with a mental health professional. So that way, one, they're able to take some of the load off the fire department. If it's a call that the fire department normally would respond to with an engine company and basically take an engine out of service to deal with a very minor medical aid, they will basically respond and they can handle things like, you know, wound dressing changes and things like that. Or if they go, if there's a whether it's a law enforcement event or if they have a ambulance or a fire engine on scene that has somebody that's dealing with a mental health crisis, they have a counselor that goes there and they have somebody that's a paramedic there that's basically can do, you know, medical things, but they also have that mental health counselor there that can basically deal with that kind of mental first aid, I guess would be the best term I can use for it.
That would be interesting. I wonder if the personality of somebody who would be a mental health professional often appears with someone who also is a paramedic or vice versa. I would think that would be a pretty unique combination, but extraordinarily valuable for a department to have. I mean, if you could have one of those profiles right along on every call, you know, when you're responding to a fire.
Right.
Okay, primary job is fire, but they got that other thing in there, so if it pops up, they just kick in automatically.
Right.
How cool would that be?
That would be great to have people that have that kind of multidisciplinary view of things, you know.
Both sides of the brain being used.
Absolutely.
Instead of like us, you know, maybe 10%.
Yeah, and we do have people, I think, that have that capability, but, you know, as a firefighter or as a firefighter paramedic, you know, you have a basically, you have a certain job that you're looking at, and I think that's why there's the benefit of having a seasoned firefighter or even a captain paramedic from the fire department right along with a mental health person. I think that differentiation in how they view things is part of the benefit because, you know, maybe someone who's worked as a mental health counselor their whole career doesn't have that street sense of basically, hey, things are starting to go sideways and we need to, you know, basically switch gears here a little bit. Whereas the captain paramedic who has that street sense may not have that other side of things. So
yeah.
I think, but if you have basically one person that could do that, that has that wherewithal to be able to switch gears like that, that would be perfect. That would be wonderful.
I wonder if there would be the opportunity, you know, and I don't know to what extent the training is,
mm-hmm.
but to have somebody get a second degree.
Yeah.
Sponsor them through, okay, you're the guinea pig. And everybody knows that that's the case and that that's, you know, the department buys that education just to see is that a valuable skill set? Is that something everybody ought to come through? Or do you have workshops and bring in some of the folks either from DHHS or from, in our situation, Humboldt, and do afternoon workshops and just kind of start working away at that?
Right. And I think that's one of the benefits we have when we are looking at new fire personnel. Right now, today, in the United States, most fire departments don't require a college degree or a special discipline like that to work there. Whereas when we see new firefighters coming in, we're seeing more and more firefighter applicants that have a degree in psychology, or they have a degree in something that may be related to that.
Oh, really? A soft skill?
Yeah. And you look at that as a chief officer and go, what does this person bring? Something really unique to the table. Not only do they basically have the little bit of expanded education for future advancement within the fire department, but man, if you have somebody that has a degree in psychology that has a little bit more education on it than the average bear, holy cow, that they might bring something special to the table that I never would have thought of.
Now, that doesn't supplant the experience and the base level requirements that you have.
Absolutely, yeah, because at the end of the day, we're firefighters and we're EMTs and paramedics, and we have to be able to do that basic job. But if you have somebody that comes in with that outside world experience that basically says, hey, we've been doing it this way for a while, what about trying this? Again, someone who's brand new as a rookie wants to become basically a good firefighter and do their job. But as they advance in their time on the department and they start seeing the operation, man, some of the best absolute ideas that we have that have made revolutions in the fire service come from the firefighters on the floor. Whether it's a new tool they develop or a new skill set that they say is relevant to what we do.
Now, if somebody had the unique background, I guess would be the simplest way, could they be an office position that then could also go along for the ride, so to speak? Or would that cross a line somewhere?
I don't think it would. We have, at Humboldt Bay Fire, we have our community risk reduction division, which is fire prevention. And I think that there's a lot of applications in that respect that having that fire background is helpful, but not always necessary in that position. But I think that they could bring some things to the table in that position that would do exactly what you're talking about.
When Kyla from the DA's office was in, she said that you had to be a sheriff or law enforcement for 5 years before you could become an investigator. Same true for a fire investigator? Do they have to be a firefighter for a period of time before they can start becoming an investigator? Or is that a different specialty and you may not need to know, you may not need to be an EMT to be able to figure out how a fire move, the physics and the chemistry of a fire blowing through to a situation?
Right. It depends on the department. I know that we basically will draw from our more experienced firefighters when you put them through fire investigation school. Fire background is very helpful. I don't know that it's 100% necessary, but looking at things with a firefighter's eye definitely helps, whether it's fire prevention or investigation. The experience definitely is a boon to helping you do the job better.
And probably based on the team size.
Yeah.
You got a couple hundred people there. You could probably have a couple investigators that knew chemistry, knew physics.
True enough.
And maybe had a fire science degree or a minor in it, but didn't actually have 10 years on the job.
Right. Yeah, that definitely, the more education you have in the background helps definitely. But that experience factor is something that you can't teach. So I think I'm biased, but I think that a fire investigator that has a firefighter background is going to do a better job.
You would. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
Hearty and healthy foods are abundant at Murphy's Markets. USDA Choice Boneless Beef Chuck Roast is now $5.99 a pound. USDA Choice New York Strip Steak, $15.99 a pound. And USDA Grade A Boneless Skinless Chicken Thighs are only $3.99 a pound. Complement this with a Greek salad, now just $7.99 a pound, topped with Kraft salad dressing for only $3.75 for a 16-ounce bottle. Murphy's Markets, more than a grocer, your neighbor since 1971.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Times, 8:47. We're back talking shop this morning with Billy Reynolds from Humboldt Bay Fire. Fire is different today than what it was before. I mean, the actual flame reaction, okay, a little bit with the chemicals, a little bit with design. I'm thinking of some of like those big cathedrals that were built in Europe.
Right.
Putting out a fire in Notre Dame. I mean, yeah. How do you put one of those out? I was in Old Town and got to play tourist guide for about 2 minutes a couple days ago, and they were looking at the Carson House. That doesn't look like original roof. No, No, it was built in 1880s. It's not original. Well, how do they put the roof on? I said, well, you know, there's specialization along with that. You know, we're in an area where there's a lot of Victorians. That's what you get. Are there architectural experts in fire also, or is that just experience? I mean, you get a new guy, and let's say they've never been inside a Victorian. Okay, and it's showtime, and here they go roaring up.
Right.
What do they know about a Victorian versus, let's say, one of the Pearson homes? Completely different.
Right.
How different is that during the training? Do you have to train to both, or is fire fire and water water and blood blood, and you just apply it to the situation as you are confronting it?
So in the state of California, we have what's called the state firefighter one, which is the basic level firefighter training or become a career firefighter. And a big component of that training is building construction, building materials, building techniques, different types of construction, roof construction. Is it a truss roof versus a flat roof versus a cut and stack roof? And what that means to you as a firefighter. So that is a massive part of our training. So that way when our people pull up on a fire, they can look at the building, and when the captain or the company officer does their size up and they're looking at, they're not just looking at how much fire is blowing out of the windows and stuff. They're saying, okay, this is a gang nail truss roof that's going to fail under heat, under very short circumstances. We don't necessarily want to put people on the roof to cut holes in it for ventilation. So that's just one example. But and we always make the joke, we want smart firefighters. We don't want people that just can kick down doors and or things like that. But we want people that can look at the situation and say, this is something that's going to go south really fast, and we don't want to kill our people. So building construction and what we do and the education on that is a massive part of what we do.
And continue to train towards.
Absolutely, because as the construction industry changes, our training is going to change, because when a new material is introduced or a new style of construction is introduced, or a new building in our community is built, that basically maybe we don't have a certain type of building, but now for whatever reason, they're building one. And I can't think of an example off the top of my head.
Well, like this thing that Danny Johnson is building on Myrtle, between 7th and Cooper's Gulch.
Yeah, the senior housing there.
That's a little unique. I mean, is it totally different than anything else that's been around? Probably not, but it is still a unique structure unto itself.
Right.
And access points and things of that nature. Do you guys kind of do the unofficial tour before it opens?
Absolutely.
Or something like that, and just kind of put eyes on and film it so that there's some kind of documentation of what to anticipate?
Yeah, so we basically have been involved with that one from the beginning. As the fire marshal, we review the plans. We basically review the sprinkler system that'll be inside of it, making sure that it's calculated correctly for the water flows and whatnot. We're also looking at operational factors, like it's a three-story building, so obviously our ground ladders on the fire engines can only go so high, so the ladder truck will be an essential component. Also, the type of people that will be living there, it's going to be senior housing. So obviously, people that are less ambulatory than a younger person. Excuse me. So a lot of these factors go in. And then as we get to a certain point, we definitely want our firefighters to take tours and be able to go through there. And also, another thing that we do is, since it's a residential apartment building, we inspect that every year, basically looking for fire hazards. Are the exit lights all still functioning?
Maintenance types of things.
Absolutely. Yeah. Making sure the sprinkler system's had its regular checks and everything, and we're not seeing things that, obviously. So the education starts at the beginning when the place is being built, but it's through the life of the building while it's occupied.
And so you'll have your threesome, your trio, walk through it each year. Do you rotate those folks, or does it tend to be, I mean, I would think that would be a plum assignment. Because it gets you out of the station and you get to meet people and see what's going on. Does that change so that you get multiple impressions with multiple people because you don't know who's going to be on duty or who's going to get that call?
Yeah. Initially, when the building is first built and is opening, we will basically set time that basically we can go through. Each engine company that's on duty on all three platoons can go through and basically see the building.
So it is like an open house.
Absolutely. Okay. And that way they can look at things and ask questions and get familiar with it. And then as we go on, we'll have what are called target hazard buildings with an elderly housing facility like that. We'll basically say, okay, we're reviewing this target hazard today or this month rather.
Oh, so you go in with a specific topic.
Yeah.
Sprinklers.
And
you're just looking at sprinklers.
Or how we're going to handle it.
Yeah, okay. That sounds like there's a science to this.
There sure is.
Probably call it fire science, huh?
Yes, that's the thing.
Thanks for coming by, bud. See everybody on Monday.